It's time for Bigler's World, right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. That makes me Jim Bigler, at least for the next hour. So we got all kinds of kids' magazines, maybe some little science news explorers for the kids. We do it all for the kids. Some National Geographic. Let's start with Dogo News for kids. See the title of this: Bronze Sword with Markings of Pharaoh Ramses II Unearthed in Egypt. John Woo wrote this little article right here. Egyptian archaeologists revealed the discovery of a gleaming bronze sword on September 5th, 2024. The weapon was marked with the insignia of Ramses II, one of ancient Egypt's most powerful pharaohs. Despite being buried for over 3,000 years, the sword has retained its reflective shine. The sword was found inside a small room in one of the mud barracks surrounding the Tel al-Abkain. That's a 3,200-year-old military fort in northwest Egypt. The presence of the pharaoh's emblem on the weapon suggests it belonged to a prominent military official. Peter Brand, he's a historian at the University of Memphis, believes that the sword's discovery suggests the fort was well defended. It probably even had on-site weapons production in the area. Brand theorized that the sword was likely a royal gift to a high-ranking officer. He told Live Science, "The king's name and titles engraved on it served as a status symbol, increasing the owner's prestige and advertising the king's wealth, power, and generosity." The ancient fort also revealed a glimpse into the daily lives of its former occupants. Though through various discoveries, the archaeologists uncovered storerooms for grain storage and ovens for baking, indicating a self-sufficient community. The excavations also yielded remains of large clay pots containing bones of fish and other animals, suggesting a diverse diet. Other items, such as bead necklaces and an applicator for kohl eyeliner, that's K-O-H-L, provided rare insight into the soldiers' personal lives. Kohl, a dark black powder, was used by ancient Egyptians to protect their eyes from the harsh desert sun. Two limestone blocks were also found. One was engraved with the name of someone called Bay, B-A-Y, while the other mentioned Ramses. Ramses II, often called Ramses the Great, he was just great. He was the second longest reigning pharaoh in ancient Egypt. He ruled for 66 years from 1279 to 1213 BCE as the third king of the 19th dynasty. Ramses II was known for his military prowess. Under his rule, Egypt's borders expanded significantly, stretching from modern-day Syria in the east to Sudan in the south. Nicknamed the Builder Pharaoh, he also commissioned numerous temples and monuments during his reign. Next up here, on Bigler's World, let's do a little scout life, or is it scouting life? Scouting life. First article we got here, scouting for clean waterways. Do a good turn by helping keep our waters clean. For the most part, plastic is good. It is the human-made material in many useful things, such as water bottles, sports safety gear, and food packaging. However, about 12 billion pounds of plastic are dumped into oceans each year. Millions more are dumped into rivers, lakes, streams, swamps, and other waterways. And this is not good. Some types of plastic take hundreds, I knew I'd get that right eventually, of years to break down. In the meantime, they pollute our water and harm wildlife. More than 1 million animals are killed each year due to plastic marine debris. Waterway and marine debris also pollute soil, and animals ingest the pollution. As a scout, you can do something to help. Scouting for Clean Waterways is a nationwide effort that begins on Earth Day, April 22nd, 2025. You have a while here to think about this. It is designed to help scouts not only use less plastic, but also properly dispose of trash, recycle, and actively participate in cleaning waterways in local communities. Any scout of any age can participate. And here's how it works, Chevy. Start now by reducing your personal use of disposable plastics. Use a refillable water bottle instead of buying a one-time use water bottle. Properly stow and dispose of trash. Talk to your adult or youth leader about doing a cleanup project in your area. Beginning on Earth Day 2025, participate in a cleanup project at a river, canal, lake, stream, swamp, beach, or other waterway in your community. Next article here, cycling through history. These scouts learned about Texas history as they biked the Mission Trails. Inside the entrance to the Mission Espada sits a large wooden weaving loom covered in strands of wool that are intertwined to create a colorful blanket. It is an example of how Mission residents used to make their clothes about 300 years ago in Texas's first mission. Let's see, who is this? Camden Redden, 15 years old. He's a Star Scout with Troop 848, and he said, "We learned about the process for weaving wool for clothes and the tools they used. We saw an archaeological dig that was being done, too." The guys from Clear Lake, Texas, admired the historical exhibits inside Mission Espada before hopping back on their bicycles and continuing their big day of cycling, a 10-mile ride toward downtown San Antonio. Lessons while riding. For more than 20 years, Troop 848 has scheduled a yearly cycling campout. One popular destination is the Mission Trails, an urban hike and bike system that connects five historical Spanish missions, including the Alamo. The missions were built in the early 1700s and served to introduce Christianity to Native Americans. In the 1830s, the Alamo famously became a central battle site during the Texas Revolution. Cycling to each mission would be a fun way for the scouts to learn about their state's history. Plus, the trip could count towards the Historic Trails Award, Camden says. "We had an on-the-trail quiz. The patrols completed a scavenger hunt covering the history of the missions." To prepare for the trip, the scouts inspected their gear twice, oh yes, making sure their helmets fit and their bicycles worked properly. If they didn't have something they needed, they got it before the trip. Let's see, Travis Redoux, 11 years old, also a scout, he says, "At the first meeting, I borrowed someone else's bike. By the next inspection, I had my bike. A bike repair shop donated one to me." On the trail, after a night at McGimsey's Scout Park, an Alamo Council camp, the guys got their gear ready for the ride. It rained the night before, but the trail soon dried out as temperatures climbed. It can get hot in Texas, even in April. The heat would pose a challenge, but the troop made sure to drink plenty of fluids. Plus, they had lots of rest stops planned. At the missions, they explored the buildings and read the information plaques. Let's see, who is this? Christopher Adams, 14 years old, a first-class scout, says, "It was fun to see parts of the culture and see the architecture that was there." The guys pedaled from mission to mission, which included climbing several hills. Theo Snell, 10 years old, a scout, says, "I thought 10 miles would be easy, but it turned out it was not. I felt super tired." A tasty reward. Some scouts tackled an extra 5 miles to fulfill a camping merit badge requirement, but everyone met up later at a downtown park called the Riverwalk. Mexican cuisine and ice cream topped off a fun, educational day. As guys ate, they waved to people riding by on tour boats. Let's see, Travis says, "I really had a feeling of accomplishment by dinner." The Historic Trails Award. Learn about our country's history by visiting a historical trail. You can find one near you. Go to go.scoutlife.org/historic-trails. If you also research, hike, or camp along the trail and complete a service project, you can earn the Historic Trails Award. Let's see about here. What is this? Ventures Scout Trek Across National Park is the next article they got here. Got one more in Boy's Life. Not Boy's Life anymore. It's Scout Life, Scouting Life. When you're on an island,
it might be safe to assume you're the biggest living thing there. But not at Isle Royale National Park in Michigan. No, no. The island in Lake Superior is home to moose, which can stand as tall as 6 feet at the shoulder and weigh 1,200 pounds. So naturally, when a bull moose approached the scouts from Troops 338 and 3380 and venturers from Crew 338 of Frankfort, Indiana, they quickly moved out of the way. Isle Royale National Park ranks as one of the largest lake islands in the world, though it is one of the least visited national parks. Fewer visitors sometimes means more opportunity to see wildlife. And moose weren't the only creatures the group spotted during its 43-mile backpacking trek last summer. They also spotted wolf and several beaver dams, hearing a beaver smack its tail on the water as they hiked by. The 5-day journey took them to remote mountaintops and past marshes and streams. Temperatures reached the 80s, so they paced themselves and adjusted plans so as not to get overheated. That sometimes meant waking up early to hike before it got too hot. The scouts and venturers wrapped up their trip by fishing in Lake Superior and playing games in camp before ferrying back to Minnesota. Okay, let's go to another publication here. On Bigler's World, on Bigler's World. Let's do a little science news. Science news. Explores. This article entitled, Zap, 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 Our Bodies Are Electric. Electric currents race through the brain, keep the heart on pace, and strengthen bones, says Bethany Brookshire, who wrote this article. Our daily lives seem to run on electricity. Electric lights illuminate our homes. Electric power runs our computers, microwave ovens, cell phones, and countless features on our cars. When we lose access to electricity, it can feel like we also lose access to much of the modern world. But there's one place where electricity never stops. Your body. When asleep or resting quietly, your heart beats between 60 and 100 times per minute. When you're angry, working out, or scared, it beats faster. What helps all the heart's millions of cells contract rhythmically over and over? And what triggers a change in the pace of that? Electricity. Many of our cells are tiny generators of electric charge. Working together, they power systems that keep our bodies going. Indeed, every second of every day, electrical signals race through your brain, heart, and muscles. By learning more about these tiny electrical signals, scientists are on the road to ushering in new treatments for when the body doesn't work quite as well as it should. Ions charge up cells. The pacing of heartbeats comes from a bundle of cells smaller than a coffee bean. It sits at the top of the heart's upper right chamber, called the sinoatrial or SA node. This is the heart's pacemaker. Natural pumps shove charged atoms, called ions, through the cell's membranes, and their movement concentrates various types of ions on the inside and outside of each cell. An ion carries a tiny electrical charge, so concentrating lots of ions on one side of a cell's membrane will give that membrane an overall electrical charge. There are positive ions on both sides of these membranes. SA node cells pump out positively charged sodium ions. As a result, the outside of their membrane has an overall positive charge. Cells of the SA node also pump positively charged potassium ions to their insides, but the potassium ions are competing with many other molecules inside the cell, most of which have a negative charge. So at rest, a pacemaker cell is more negatively charged inside than out. To trigger a heartbeat, pacemaker cells in the SA node open channels at one site in their membranes. Because there are more sodium ions on the outside, those ions will rush inside the cell. They're trying to balance the electrical charges on either side. That ion flow changes the electrical charge across the membrane. Now, other channels in the cell's membrane open. This allows potassium ions to go racing out. Again, they are trying to balance their concentrations inside and outside of the cell. Each channel set opens in one tiny area of the cell's membrane. Ions that rush into the cell change the electrical charge in little ways anyway. This triggers more channels to open farther down the membrane, sending waves of changing electric charge down the length of a cell. This is really complicated. Scientists refer to this zap as an action potential. Bum, bum. The natural pacemaker's clocks. Cells in the SA node that zap all at once, each collective zap is like the beat of a metronome. Two tiny clocks set this pace at which the metronome beats, explains Edward Lakata. He's a cardiologist, or doctor who studies and treats diseases of the heart. He works at the National Institute of Health Laboratory of Cardiovascular Science in Baltimore, Maryland. One clock is that zap or action potential. After each zap, the membrane's cells in the SA node must reset. To do this, the body sends ions back across each cell's membrane to their starting side. The SA node's zaps can speed up or slow down, but their pace is limited by the membrane's reset time, which ranges from about 0.1 to 0.5 seconds. The main ions in an action potential are sodium and potassium, but in the heart, calcium ions also play a timekeeping role. Normally, pacemaker cells store positive calcium ions deep inside themselves, but some of these positively charged ions are constantly dribbling out into the body of the cell. When the number of these escapes gets high enough, the cell membrane's ion channels open. This triggers an action potential mentioned above. Later in the body, they will send those calcium ions back into storage. The length of time this takes serves as the second sort of clock. Put together two clocks and keep your SA node generating new electrical zaps all its own, and make sure it keeps them at a healthy pace. When the pacemaker keeps bad time. Unfortunately, things sometimes go awry. Cells in the SA node might not fire together. Sometimes they might not fire at all. In those cases, doctors install a battery-powered device to serve as the master pacemaker. It sends timed micro-zaps to the SA node to keep it running. If that node intermittently stops, then the heart will need a special pacemaker, Lakata says. This is one doesn't work until it's needed. It can sense how fast the SA node is working and only kicks in when that node is working too slowly. That's why it's known as an on-demand pacemaker, he says.
You know, likely you can get movies on demand.
But the pacing of heartbeats isn't behind all problems. No, no, no. Sometimes the vessels that move blood around get blocked. Lacking blood and oxygen, a spot of cells in the heart tissue may die. This is known as a heart attack. Although many people can survive a heart attack, this event leaves a scar. Here, the heart no longer conducts or responds to electrical signals, which can upset its stable beating. Let's see, who is this? Ren Ki Lai is a cardiovascular surgeon at the Toronto General Hospital Research Institute in Canada. He and his team have developed a tiny patch for heart attack survivors. Made of a hydrogel, this patch can conduct pacemaking zaps across a scarred heart tissue so that the heart's healthy cells won't stop contracting in unison. His team developed a second hydrogel, too. It reinforces the heart's electrical timekeeping. This pair of gels also provides a scaffold on which new heart cells can cling and grow. Right now, Lee's group is testing these gels in rats. Someday, the patches might help human hearts heal, all the while keeping their electricity flowing. Electricity on the brain. The brain is another hive of electrical activity. Some of its cells, neurons, have long tails called axons. These serve as a path along which electrical signals travel. Those electrical signals are how the brain processes and transmits information. Like pacemaker cells in the heart, neurons are more negatively charged on the inside than on the outside. When an electrical signal needs to get passed between neurons, ion channels open up in the cell's membrane. As with heart cells, this allows ions to flow in and out, changing the neuron's electrical charge. Neural signals move fast. A signal can sprint from the nerve cell in your big toe to those in your spinal cord and on up to your brain at up to 120 meters or 400 feet per second. So if you've stubbed your toe, you will know it in less than half a second. And in another half second, signals from your brain back to the leg and toe will help you hop around in pain. It's not just one neuron that sends a signal from the toe to the brain and back. Groups of brain neurons fire together in what is known as oscillations, notes Helen Mayberg. Who is she? She's a neurologist, someone who studies and treats diseases of the brain. She works at the Icahn School of Medicine. It is part of the Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. Each oscillation is the sum of all the firing of neurons in a given area. Mayberg likens it to a choir of cells singing together. Some cells in this chorus have special bands of insulating material wrapped around their axons or tails. Called a myelin sheath, each of these bands helps keep ions from escaping so that the electrical melody won't diminish. Tiny gaps separate these sheaths from each other along the length of an axon, giving each its own personal space. The uncovered gaps between the myelin sheaths on a neuron's axon are super sensitive to electrical charges. They also have a lot of ion channels. An electrical signal generated in the neuron can skip across these gaps much faster than if it could only ripple down the distance inside the axon, and it bounces along gaps in the myelin without the signal getting any weaker. This allows the electrical signals to move at the whip-fast speeds needed to let you know that a stove is hot or that you've stubbed your toe. When the axons of many neurons in the brain or spinal cord are covered in myelin, they look like a white band. Those bands are electrical superhighways relaying the choir's tune, explains Mayberg. In some brain disorders and diseases, however, something can block the flow of this melody from getting into its intended audience. Perhaps the neurons and their myelin are damaged, or the cells producing oscillations might get out of sync. Some groups of neurons might even die. In all these cases, the results can be terrible. When some neurons in the brain die, for instance, others can start to oscillate out of sync. The body can now get conflicting signals. For instance, it may no longer know when to start a movement. This may cause someone's limbs to tremble, or they might struggle to walk, reach for things, and more. These symptoms, for instance, those are the symptoms, for instance, for Parkinson's disease. Brain zapping therapy. Doctors will sometimes implant electrodes deep into the brain to treat Parkinson's disease. High-frequency electrical signals from those electrodes will cut off the problem oscillations, Mayberg explains. Now patients can move normally again, at least for a few years. Mayberg and her colleagues there have begun developing a similar deep brain stimulation for people with depression. This mental illness can trigger extreme long-term sadness. Medicines or other treatments can help some people with depression, but other people don't respond well to those therapies. Mayberg's group suspected that patients' resistance to treatment might be due to faulty electrical oscillations in their brains. To test this, her team sent electrical signals through electrodes implanted at a site right behind the bridge of the nose. This lifted the mood of some patients. Last year, the team had even more success by stimulating nearby white matter, myelin-sheathed neurons. Before they inserted an electrode, Mayberg's group now studies careful maps of the patient's brain and recordings of its electrical activity, Mayberg explains. You're listening for sites of abnormal cell firing. When you find the right spot, she says, and inject the current, you interrupt that abnormal firing immediately. Mayberg's team is finding that a little electricity in the right place can make a big difference in boosting the patient's mood. Shocked to the bone. Bones also respond to electricity. Many people think that bone, let's see, who is this talking? Greg Wohl of McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, says it's sort of inert, you know, see the bones there. Inert things are passive, so if bone were inert, it would just passively hold us up and serve as a place for muscles to attach. But bone tissue can adapt or change in a lot. Sensing electricity is key to that, Wohl says. A biomechanical engineer, that is, he studies how bones respond to physical stress. And our bones are constantly under stress. It comes from carrying a heavy load. When you put a mechanical load on your skeleton, every time you lift a big backpack, do a handstand, or even walk, with each stress, Wohl notes, little cracks are forming and progressing through the bone. Over time, these little cracks build up. The same thing happens to lots of other hard structural materials, he says. Think about the axles on rail cars or the wings on planes, even bridges over which we drive our cars. With time, the stress of those heavy loads can wear down the support materials. Eventually, Wohl notes, they'll need to be repaired by ripping them down or taking them out and replacing them. But the body can't pop. That is, the body can't pop in a whole new bone when one wears out. What it can do is break down and replace affected cells around those cracks. Bone is made up of three main cell types. The first, osteoclasts, are bone munchers. They break down old, worn-down bone bits and reabsorb them. A second type, osteoblasts, they help build new bone material where it's needed. In time, this second type will morph into the third type, true bone osteocytes. In the 1950s, scientists realized that the surface of bone, stressed by weight, has a slightly negative charge. If the bone bends slightly, not enough to break, it develops a slightly positive charge. When carrying no weight, the bone has no charge. This means bone is piezoelectric. It produces an electric charge when bent or squeezed. Wohl has seen this in beef bone that his team got from a grocery store. They just gave it to us, he recalls, because, of course, they don't use it. After cutting it up into little domino shapes, his team put electrodes on each side of those bone pieces. When we bent the bone dominoes, he says, we were able to generate a little spike of charge that slowly dropped off over time, yeah? It's those charges that stimulate bone to make repairs and get stronger. And a loaded bone with negative charge stimulates osteoblasts to make more bone. A bent bone with positive charge stimulates osteoclasts to break bone down. Wohl's team is now investigating which types of electrical pulses might work best to boost bone healing. There are lots of devices on the internet that claim to electrically heal or strengthen bone, but it's not clear which types will work best, if at all, for a particular type of injury, Wohl says. Scientists are also working out how to use those electrical charges to keep bones strong even when there's no load on our skeleton, such as during a space flight. Let's see, is this him again? I guess it is. It's actually really important because if we're going to send people to Mars, they're going to be in a spaceship, he says. In that spaceship, they'll be weightless for a year and a half. During that time, the astronauts' bones won't feel a need to repair themselves. The risk, Wohl says, is that astronauts may step on Mars and break a hip. All those electrical signals that move through our bodies aren't just quirks. We couldn't live without them. Our hearts wouldn't beat, our brains wouldn't function, and our bones would break. But with just the right jolts of electricity, scientists may be able to lift people's moods, help their hearts beat in sync, and even keep space travelers strong. Okay, let us go to another publication here on Bigler's World. It's Bigler's World on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's do some frontiers for young minds. Do we worry too much about what others think of us? Says Zhao Huang, Sanders Thomas and Wouter Wolf. Those people wrote this article. I just had to do it. See, what is the liking gap? Have you ever worried about how people feel about you after hanging out with them for the first time? Mm-hmm. If you have, you're not the only one. It turns out, after meeting someone new, most people like the other person more than they think the other person likes them back. But if both people feel that way, then at least one of them is mistaken. So it seems that when we meet new people, we suffer from an illusion called the liking gap. We imagine that others like us less than we like them back. See, the first study that discovered the liking gap was done with adults. Researchers invited college students to come to a research laboratory where they chatted with another person they did not know. Afterward, they were asked separately how much they liked this other person and how much they thought the other person liked them back. The researchers found that most students said they liked the other person, but they thought the other person liked them less. The length of the conversation did not matter. Students felt this way after talking for a couple of minutes, but also when they chatted for 45 minutes. Even more surprising was that the liking gap stuck around for a while, even after people got to know each other. Even after 6 months, students still experienced a liking gap, and it was only 9 months after 9 months that the liking gap no longer existed. Do researchers also find liking gaps in real life? You may be asking yourself this very moment. Researchers asked a new group of college students the same questions. The students talked to each other, but this time they did not know they were part of a study. They were told that they were taking part in a workshop on how to talk to strangers better. Even in this situation, students thought that the person they were talking to liked them less than they liked them back. Finally, the liking gap is not just a trick the mind plays on us when we're talking to one person. One study showed that the liking gap still exists even in a group. How does the liking gap develop in children? Let's see, how does this liking gap emerge and develop? Do we experience this illusion from the day we are born? Probably not. For babies, thinking about how others feel about them is probably too difficult. But what about older kids? To find out, we tested groups of children from 4 to 11 years old. It took quite some time to do the testing. We only finished the study 1.5 years after we tested the first child. We asked children to play together for 5 minutes and then separated them and asked how much they liked the other child, if they would like to play with the other child again, and how much they wanted to be friends with the other child. They then also guessed how the other child felt about these things. The youngest children, who were 4 years old, did not show a liking gap. But for all the older children, starting with the 5-year-olds, the liking gap was there. For the 5-year-olds, the liking gap was not so big yet, but the older the children were tested, the larger the gap got. So it seemed like once children hit 5, they start to feel more insecure about how others feel about them. And this feeling gets stronger as they get older. If that score is 0, there is no liking gap because then the child likes the other person just as much as they think the other person likes them back. However, if that score is larger than 0, then a child likes the other person more than they think the other person likes them back. So in this case, it is a liking gap because not every child answers the same. We averaged the liking gap for children in each age group. Also, we did not test all the children in the world. That means it's possible that by chance we only tested children who, for example, had very high or very low liking gaps. We therefore have some uncertainty about how big the liking gap actually is in the real world for different age groups, even after looking at the data. To deal with this uncertainty, does not simply show one liking group score per age group, but a range of liking gap scores that are the most likely for each group. The range is shown in the graph on the lines between two black dots. The more children we tested in the age groups, the more we can be certain about their scores, and thus the shorter the line. See, they go on and on about that specific here. Why do we have a liking gap? Psychologists do not only want to find what people think or feel, but why people think or feel that way. For the liking gap, we are not completely sure how it works, but we have some ideas about why it might happen. One idea comes from research on children. The liking gap is not the only thing that happens for the first time when children are 5 years old. At the same age, children start to worry about what others think about them. This worry about their reputation causes children to think things like, how do others feel about me? Do they want to be my friends? Do they want to hang out with me? We can all see this in their behavior. From age 5, children become more helpful if others can see that they are being kind, so these children will think better of them. But they are less helpful when there is no one around to see this. Perhaps it is the same to worry about how others feel about them that causes children to think that others like them less when they like them. One question for future research is how changes in the brain might cause this development. Another idea is that when we are talking to other people, we have to think so much about what we do and say, we forget to pay attention to how others are reacting to us. Have you ever met someone for the first time and you both say your names, but then 5 seconds later, you have forgotten their name? You were probably so busy thinking about what you have to say that you forgot to listen to the other person telling you their name. In the same way, we might often be so busy thinking about what we have to say that we fail to see how the other person reacts to us, especially when this reaction is quick or not so easy to see, like a small smile. Now, perhaps if others showed that they liked us very clearly, this would not be that much of a problem. But it turns out that when other people like us or like talking to us, they often do not tell us directly. Think about how other people, how often you have heard someone say, I like talking to you, directly to your face. It makes it even harder to know how others actually feel about us. We are therefore not sure about how the things we do or say make other people feel. But because we care about how others feel about us, when we often start thinking about all the things we might have done wrong while hanging out with them, perhaps because we want to do these things better next time. This can sometimes be useful, but we think we do things wrong much more often than we do in the eyes of other people, making us feel worse than we need to. Is the liking gap good, bad, or a bit of both? You may be asking yourself at this very moment. So our liking gap might always be good for us. It might make us feel bad when talking to other people, or perhaps we become insecure in talking to new people. This might cause us to feel lonely or sad. But perhaps sometimes the liking gap might also be helpful to us. Remember when we talked about how it can be difficult to know how others think about us? It might seem of little use then what we think of that we think that others like us less than they actually do. In many cases, we feel bad for no reason. But what if we were wrong the other way around? What if we naturally thought that others liked us more than they actually do? So an opposite liking gap. Scientists think that this might even be worse. If people who are important to us do not like us as much as we think they do, then we think everything is all right, and we might not put in extra effort to be nice and helpful to those people, and perhaps we spend more time with other people. But if we keep doing that, the people who are important to us might think that we do not care about them or that they are not important to us. This might cause them to not be our friends anymore and to look for other friends instead. So if we do not worry enough about what other people, whether people like us, we might lose our friends and end up feeling lonely. So if you sometimes feel that others like you less than you like them back, there's no reason to panic for two reasons. First, feeling this way might help make sure that you behave nicely and are helpful to other people, which helps building friendships. Second, you are not the only person feeling this way. The other person might feel the exact way you do. In fact, they are likely enjoying hanging out just as much as you do, or perhaps even more. Okay, let's do one more article from Frontiers for Young Minds. This one entitled, Earth's Interconnected Climate, Understanding Our Changing World. Matthew Collins wrote this along with Vicky Thompson. Gabriel Eggert goes like this here. Earth's complex climate network. Imagine Earth as a giant complex system with air, water, land, and ice all talking to each other through a language we call climate. Like talking on a telephone to a friend across the world, Earth's climate conversation stretches over thousands of kilometers. maybe even miles, from the icy poles to the tropical regions near the equator. Not only do the parts of Earth's climate system talk to each other, but they can affect each other in all kinds of complicated ways to produce the weather you experience wherever you live, like heat waves, dry spells, or heavy rains. These long-distance climate effects are called teleconnections, and they are a natural part of Earth's climate system. Teleconnections explained. Teleconnections are like invisible threads weaving across the Earth, connecting weather and climate events in one part of the world to things that happen thousands of kilometers away. Remember that weather describes daily, short-term conditions of the atmosphere, while climate describes long-term patterns. There are several teleconnected pathways, and many of them are created by the constantly changing circulation of air in the atmosphere and water in the oceans. One of the most well-known examples of teleconnection is the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, which involves natural, periodic changes in ocean water temperatures, air pressure, rainfall, and in the way water circulates in the Pacific Ocean. For example, when the Pacific Ocean warms up in the normally cool eastern tropics, it can cause floods in one part of the world and droughts in another. Yikes. The trade winds, which will blow in from the west to the east in tropical regions of the Earth, keep the warmest water near the Asian coast and bring up cold water from the depths near South America. Every now and then, the trade winds get weaker, and instead of Asian coastal waters, the waters in the middle of the Pacific get warmer. Warm waters make it easier for rain and thunderstorms to form, so these also move from the Asian coast further into the Pacific. Rain systems are all connected in the atmosphere, so regions that are normally wet get drier, such as Indonesia, which can experience wildfires, and other areas, such as California in the U.S., get more rain. There are also teleconnections between Earth's polar regions and the rest of the planet. For example, the jet streams are giant, invisible rivers of air high up in the sky that move from west to east. Jet streams are caused by two things: Earth's rotation and the difference in temperature between the equator and the poles. Jet streams play a big role in Earth's weather. They can affect how storms move and how warm or cold it gets in various places. Jet streams are like highways for weather systems, helping them travel across the globe. Using computers to predict climate change. Figuring out climate complexities and how teleconnections work is the job of researchers called climate scientists. Climate scientists use powerful computers to create programs called climate models, which can help them understand climate teleconnections of the present climate and project or predict the effects that climate change will have both on teleconnections and on the resulting weather conditions in specific regions of the world. A climate model is basically a virtual version of the real world in which scientists can do experiments to see how changes in one thing, like the amount of greenhouse gases that humans release, affect other things, like global temperatures or the amount of rainfall in a certain region. Many climate models exist, but they all represent the different components of climate, including sea ice changes, sea level rise, rainfall amounts, or the number and strength of heat waves, for example, and how they interact. Teleconnections and climate change. You may have heard that 2023 was the world's warmest year on record, but temperatures are not increasing in exactly the same way all over the world, and other effects of climate change vary by location, too. So what might rising global temperatures mean for the weather and climate where you live? Well, that is a very difficult question for climate scientists to answer, especially since, as Earth's climate changes due to human activities, the behavior of teleconnections is changing, too. For example, monsoons bring vital rain to many parts of the world, but the rain they bring has become more intense in some places in recent years due to climate change. Monsoons are heavy rainstorms that happen mostly in tropical areas during the rainy season. As greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide build up, they change the temperatures of the oceans and the atmosphere. When these temperatures are out of balance, natural teleconnections can be disrupted. For example, scientists have observed that changes in ENSO can make monsoons stronger and can also lead to increases in other extreme weather conditions in some regions, such as more and stronger hurricanes and longer droughts. Similarly, as sea ice melts in the Arctic, it might weaken and shift the jet stream southward. This could bring stormier conditions to the Mediterranean and drier, more settled conditions to Western Europe. Jet streams are naturally quite variable. They do not stay in the same place or move at the same speed all the time, so scientists are still uncertain about exactly how much the melting ice at the poles might be shifting the jet stream and increasing its variability, leading to extreme weather events. There is still much work to be done to fully understand this and other teleconnections and the role that climate change might be playing in changing them. Computer models aren't perfect. What? Climate scientists are unsure what caused 2023's record-breaking temperatures because, as you've seen, Earth's climate is extremely complicated. This means that to make the most accurate predictions, climate models must be complicated too. There's not enough computing power in the world to create one model that includes every possible feature of the Earth's climate accurately. Also, climate scientists use different methods to model different features, such as ocean currents, atmospheric conditions, ice caps melting, and the effects of human activities like deforestation and pollution. Even the best models are not perfect. They cannot capture every aspect of extremely complex climate processes with complete accuracy, so the predictions they provide are never 100% certain. This explains why different climate models do not always give the same results. For example, one model might say storms more frequently move northward, after another might say they often move southward. Okay, that's a contradiction. One way to deal with this is for climate scientists to look at lots of models to figure out which models are the best for which questions. They can also combine information from multiple models to help make the best predictions of how climate change will affect specific areas. Analyzing and combining information from climate models is extremely important because knowledge is power. The more a certain scientist can be about how climate change will affect specific locations, the more effectively local authorities will be able to protect those areas. For example, if scientists can project with very high certainty that sea level rise and increased rainfall will flood New York City over the next 50 years, steps can be taken in advance to protect people, like building flood walls or moving people out of areas most likely to flood. Accurate climate knowledge also helps scientists to measure the success of actions taken to fight climate change, like laws to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. Preparing for the future. As Earth warms, we are seeing more and more extreme weather and climate events, from blistering heat waves to torrential rains. We now know that, due to climate teleconnections, the specific causes for certain weather events might be thousands of kilometers away. Teleconnections show us that Earth's climate system is deeply interconnected, with changes in one area rippling across the globe. Understanding teleconnections is an important part of predicting how climate change will affect communities in the future, and climate modeling is helping climate scientists do just that. By studying information from many climate models, scientists can better forecast weather and climate trends, helping communities prepare for and fight climate change and extreme weather events. Hopefully, the more we learn about Earth's fascinating and complex climate system, the easier it will be to learn to live within its limits and reduce the negative impact that humans are having on the environment. Okay, let's go to a different publication here. On Bigler's World. Let's do a little CBC Kids News. It's kid news, kid news. This is from the first person section. How Alzheimer's changed my relationship with my grandma. Yvonne Murphy wrote this right here. She says, when I was 8 years old, my grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Back then, I didn't understand what this meant, nor how far-reaching the implications would be. In the 7 years since, Mum, as we call her, is now 81 and has changed into a very different person of herself. I can still identify glimpses of the person she once was, but our relationship has changed. The knowledge that my grandma will continue to deteriorate has helped me gain a new appreciation for our time together and this current version of her. Growing up with my grandma. As a young kid, I knew my grandma, whose name is Mary, to be energetic and endlessly empathic. She took care of my sisters and my mom when my mom was working. We spent many days walking the beach, painting, and going to playgrounds. She would make us pancakes or cinnamon toast and read stories and craft with us and bathe us at the end of the day. These are countless times I watched her smiling at strangers, showing kindness to everyone we met, especially children, and going out of her way to lighten the burdens of others. Getting used to the changes. My grandma started showing signs of cognitive decline, such as losing her car keys and sunglasses, and struggling to remember things that had happened earlier that day. My family initially chalked it up to normal age-related memory loss. It soon became clear that my grandma's condition was worsening too much and too quickly for this to be the case. No one in my family, including myself, wanted to believe that there was something wrong with her. Coming to terms with her diagnosis. It was painful to learn that she had Alzheimer's disease, especially because we knew the disease would only progress. At first, I really struggled to accept this. I loved my grandma, and I wanted her to be there, mentally and physically, for all the important life events in my future. But I knew that this was no longer realistic, and I realized that I now had to be there for her. Over time, she stopped recognizing friends and then family members. She began to experience episodes of extreme fear, irritability, and confusion. Sometimes she would run away into downtown Vancouver, wearing her slippers and no coat in the winter. This was one of the most stressful periods of her illness. My family and I were often left to chase her through the city, sometimes at night, tracking her using an eye tag on her belt loop. I felt horrible imagining my grandma walking through the city, cold, confused, and frightened. Holding onto the present when the future is so uncertain, it became harder to see the person she once was. But I still saw glimpses of her when she laughed at me and held my hand, when she appreciated the beauty of a sunset and the warm feeling of being cleanly washed, when she looked at me and she knew she was seeing someone she loved. As my grandma's condition worsened, I still loved her, even when she lost the ability to reciprocate the sentiment verbally. One of the hardest parts of having a loved one with Alzheimer's is the knowledge that their disease is incurable and progressive. For me, this means coming to terms with the fact that my grandma is not going to get better. I know that in several years, months, or even weeks, I will be left wishing for the present version of my grandma back. Although this knowledge used to make me feel despair about the future, I've found that my perspective on her illness has shifted. Understanding that my time with her is limited actually helps me stay grounded in the present. Nowadays, my grandma can't engage verbally with me, but we still connect in other ways. When I visit her, we sit together holding hands and watch the boats passing by her window like we used to do when I was younger. In these moments, I feel grateful I still get to share experiences with her, despite her disease. When she smiles or hums a tune, I can appreciate her for who she is, not just who she was. I still enjoy our time together, and I'm sure that she does too. Okay, let's go back to Dogo News for kids. It's for kids. Earthworms boost crop yields and protect plants from microplastics. I didn't know that. Marcella Bonnet wrote this article here. Earthworms are well known for their ability to enrich, and improve soil, yet their precise impact on plant growth had remained a mystery. Now, two groundbreaking studies have found that these creepy crawlers not only boost crop yields, but also protect plants from harmful microplastics. In late 2023, a research team from Colorado State University, CSU, reported that earthworms are responsible for 6.5%, or as much as 140 million tons, of global food production annually. This is comparable to Russia's annual grain harvest, which is the world's fourth largest. So the article continues down here. CSU's Stephen Fonte and his team arrived at this conclusion after a comprehensive study. They surveyed earthworm populations, soil properties, and crop yields from around the world. The researchers focused on four grains. You got your rice, maize, wheat, and barley. They also measured the harvests of legumes like soybeans and peas. The team found that the earthworm's impact was significant in developing countries. For example, they helped increase grain yield by 10% in sub-Saharan Africa and 8% in Latin America. Fonte and his team believe farmers in these regions likely lack easy access to fertilizers and pesticides. That makes them more reliant on earthworm-rich organic matter, such as manure and crop residues. Let's see, who is this? Fonte says, earthworms are contributing a lot in these areas where we have found fewer chemical inputs. If we manage our soils in a more sustainable way, we can better harness or leverage this biodiversity and produce more sustainable agroecosystems. That's where they put agro and ecosystems together. Let's see, they got the benefits of earthworms. Nutrient availability. Earthworms encourage roots to penetrate deeper into the soil, reaching extra nutrients and moisture. Drainage. Soils with earthworms drain up to 10 times faster than soils without earthworms. Soil structure. Earthworms help rebuild topsoil by digesting and mixing dry matter with the soil. And finally, productivity. Earthworms increase soil biological activity, leading to reduced production costs and higher yields. Get yours today. Earthworms help plants grow in several ways. Their burrowing creates channels that loosen and aerate soil. This allows water to drain from the surface and be stored underground. The earthworm's constant movement helps them churn the soil's organic matter, making the nutrients more available to the plants. In a separate study, scientists at Japan's Nikkei University found that earthworms can also protect plants from microplastic pollution. The researchers tested this by placing tomato plants in soil contaminated with tiny plastic particles. They found that when earthworms were present, the plants thrived despite the pollution. They were also able to repel common plant eating bugs. Scientists revealed their findings in September of 2024. They believe that earthworms help boost the tomato plant's immune system. This makes them more resilient to environmental changes. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.